So we have to come to the market with a point of view, but we do want that point of view to be informed by customers.
This product, are we recording?
Oh my God, sorry. Better Product, the only show that takes a behind-the-scenes look into how digital products are created,
the business is built around them, and how you too can innovate better product. I'm Christian.
I'm Anna.
Welcome to today's show.
We have conversations all the time with product companies, and it's so interesting to learn how they sell, how they decide what innovations, features, or integrations are needed, and how they prepare themselves for the future. A common thread throughout all these conversations tends to be that the customer drives all decisions. Or rather, in developing product, you have to be customer informed. Christian, would you agree with that?
I think overall I would. I think the challenge is figuring out just what it means for customers to really drive your decisions. And thankfully, on this episode, we'll talk with Dan Moyers, who's the VP of Product and Solutions for 120 Water Audit, and he's going to show us how. In this particular conversation, to your point, Anna, it dives into the very notion of building product based on customer feedback. Where does product come into play with a market that traditionally uses pen and paper? How do they know when it was time to bring a new product discipline to the company? Dan will touch on this and more.
120, from a software product standpoint, really got started serving a single very large customer and doing it really well. So there was other markets, so we needed to end up creating a second product and then taking that existing one product and selling it to the next 5, 10, 20, 50 customers.
Their founder, Megan Glover, started with a vision that's ultimately evolved to
protecting public health through clean drinking water. So if you think about the customers that we serve with our software and our water testing kits, it's public water systems, it's schools, it's state agencies who are executing programs that protect public health by ensuring clean drinking water.
For Dan, product leadership has been instrumental in ensuring that what they build aligns not just to the market, but also to what the legislature dictates. It's an interesting discussion as we weave through both product and sales and engineering and government. Ultimately, establishing that without great product leadership, there can be no product. And when it comes to the vision of the company and the vision for the product, there can sometimes be a disconnect. For Dan, it's about leaning into an entire organization seeking a counterbalance between his vision as head of product and Megan's vision as a CEO.
When it comes to challenging, we probably do it around the why now, why that's important. So if she may have an idea, my polite challenge question to her is, yes, we could do that. Why should we and why should we now? And on the flip side, she'll challenge back and say, why aren't we doing this now? So we have some kind of fun around that aspect.
As we dive in and reflect on this conversation we have with Dan, I can't help but think that more often than not, are we over-engineering, over-demoing, over-creating, instead of just talking with end users to find out what they actually want?
Stop talking and just get down to business and bring folks on as a customer and move forward with them. You can demo yourself into oblivion, and sometimes it actually works against you.
So why would you choose to do the click-through as opposed to like building some big product? Why was that a better solution for your team?
Well, for us, we think it scales well as we grow the sales team because we don't have to have, for everybody, kind of, we'll say, deep demo expertise. And we just aren't finding so far that this market, you know, needs to have, I'm going to say, the classic, you know, 2-3 hour demo with everything loaded up with their actual data in order to buy the solution. Again, keep in mind, they're executing a program. They want a solution to do that. What we're finding is that, you know, they see the capability of that and they're good with that. And we also have a track record of customers who have used it and adopted it. That helps us there too.
What goes into this click-through demo? I think I know what you mean by that.
Sure.
Just maybe it's our audience. What exactly is a click-through prototype?
We do, I'm just going to say, mega high-fidelity mock-ups of all of our screens before we send those to engineering for development. So what we do is we leverage those mock-ups, and we use, in our case, we use the Envision tool, and we just stitch those together, publish that to the web, and so our sales folks have a clickable demo that they could use, you know, both in real time online or offline through the Envision app, let's say in their iPad or iPhone.
You mentioned they don't necessarily need to have all their data loaded up in a huge demo, but if you already have a development team there, why not just have them code up some sort of throwaway, you know, code that you go out to? Why spend time on a high fidelity mockup when you're going to build the product anyway?
That is how we want to do development. We really want to use the iteration of getting to high fidelity mockups to tease out the details of a feature. So if we're going to do it as part of our development methodology, then why not leverage that into a sales enablement tool? So we did it, I would say, initially in service of the approach to development we want to take. And then we're sitting back. This is just fully leverageable into a sales enablement tool.
So you're saying, because you had the high fidelity mockups that you were going to utilize for your dev processes, why not
put them together? And that's kind of why I call it a twofer. Now, we were fortunate that we have a sales team that embraces that and feels comfortable with that, you know, versus kind of, you know, pounding away and saying, well, where's my, you know, one-off demo for every different scenario imaginable? And quite frankly, at the size we are now, 20 people at present, and again, yes, we're in scale-up mode, but we're just like, we're so busy, we don't think it's a good use of resources to be doing one-off custom demos, loading data.
So you're saying that, like, as part of your dev process, the high-fidelity mockups allow, like, your team to reverse engineer it in a way?
Yeah, it drives conversation, too. We take a customer-informed approach to product management, and by that, it's we are seen as a leader in the space right now. So we have to come to the market with a point of view, but we do want that point of view to be informed by customers. And so we try to find that balance. And so, you know, another way that sometimes folks will approach it is, you know, we're customer driven. And I get that. But this customer informed, I feel like, is a bit of a balance where here's our point of view, and then here's let's have a reaction to that, and we're going to kind of use that as an input to what we're doing.
Talk a little bit more about that, what it means to be customer informed versus customer driven.
So, good example, we have our newest customer in Wisconsin, and so as we were talking to them, they're very much a thought leader and kind of a leader in their particular state. And so we put together a deal in which they're an R&D customer. And just the other day, we have a set of new features upcoming in the next couple months that we have high fidelity or mega high fidelity screen mocks for. And we wanted to get their feedback. In essence, we wanted to be informed by them to kind of get their take on it. So we would show those to them and kind of get their feedback. But for us to expect as an R&D partner that they would just tell us what they want, I think sounds good on paper. Or sounds good in theory, but the reality is different.
And so in this example, you bring to the table something, some manifestation of that with these mega high fidelity mockups, and then they give you feedback. Is there ever a time where you go in without anything? Is it ever more appropriate where you're just in a scouting, fact-finding, you know, mission versus going there with a perspective?
I think what you're describing absolutely is important. And I think more of that lies ahead for us. At the moment, from what we've been able to gauge from our current and prospective customers, what we've created and what we're creating right now is just kind of bringing us up to the level, if you will, kind of to the table stakes of what they need. And in the future, we'll be needing to operate more like that. So I think a good example would be looking out in the future. As we continue to have more customers and they have, you know, data in our platform, when it comes to something, let's say it is insights or predictive analytics around their data, I'm just going to say that broadly, we wouldn't just come up with our own point of view on what those things would be. That would be more of a, let's sit down and say, what are the kinds of questions predictively, if you could have answered for you, that might be interesting to you? And then we would kind of work our way back from there.
So you're saying today you're basically digitizing their pre-existing process. That's kind of the route that you're on in a more thought leadership oriented way. But tomorrow you might be, that's where you'll be delivering things that maybe they don't even realize.
Which I think ties back into, you know, kind of first meeting folks where they are so they can become a customer and you can start that relationship. And then you look forward to kind of growing together over time. And I think by just the broader point was, we take this customer-informed approach where we're not going to just kind of sit with our arms crossed and wait to hear what our customers need. I feel like on the customer side, they expect us to give them a point of view and provide something to react to. And then as we do that, we want to be informed as to what they think about that as we make kind of decisions. And I think that's probably the nuance that I'm trying to drive at.
What do you do when you go into a customer, let's say focus group, if you're doing a focus group, and you show them this new feature and you know this is the cat's pajamas, but they don't get it. What do you do in that moment?
My general approach is to embrace all feedback and just kind of absorb it. So in essence, don't react, but kind of thoughtfully respond. Because sometimes going back to timing, it's a great idea whose time just hasn't, you know, come yet. So you try not to be, from a product leader, product management, defensive about it, because everybody has their point of view. I think something I found over the years works well too is how you receive feedback as a product leader is very much drives how that relationship with that customer or prospect will evolve. Kind of how you handle that, it can kind of be a bonding experience. You know, if somebody says, let's say, catch pajamas that you think is a feature, and they're like, I don't like it or I don't need that now, like how you handle that, some kind of like the challenges make you stronger type of thing. So I've tried to keep that in mind over the years.
How do you handle that thing? Because surely that must happen internally, but to Anna's point, that's wrong or just not right, or they're not getting it. How do you specifically handle it?
My first reaction is the wrong word, response, actually walk right into that one, is to really kind of then scratch at why. So why do they feel that way? Kind of what's, you know, driving that perspective? And sometimes you might be asking that why question two or three times in a row. But I guess for me personally, it's having spent time in consulting a good bit over the years, doing that in a very relaxed way is key, because it kind of, you know, disarms folks and it kind of allows you to have more of a conversation about it versus we're on the pot, but more like kind of, you know, where you're kind of getting like this and, you know, getting defensive about it. And just kind of unpack it and kind of take your time to do that.
Is the approach you're describing extended out to the sales team, or are you typically having these conversations with customers? What's that division of work like?
So a lot of what we focus on right now from a roadmap is not necessarily sitting in a room, if you will, with blank whiteboards and coming up with new things. It's taking a collection of 2 years maybe worth of known things that we want to do and then sensing the market to kind of determine timing on those things. And one comment as I'm saying that I wanted to add to it is, while as a company we feel like we're in scale-up mode versus, let's say, startup stage, in some respects, you feel like it might be easier at that stage, but I actually feel like it's harder, because there can be a temptation if you're maturing as a company to get a bit too hard-coded and too master planned with your roadmap, and then you lose some of that nimbleness, you know, because the market is still unfolding. And so I try to balance a set of things that are, you know, 6 to 12 months out with nimbleness, you know, over the next 1 to 2 quarters. So, and this has kind of really just been hitting us here in the last couple of months as we've kind of been, you know, trying to take things to the next level.
What does it mean to be a scale-up versus a startup, at least for 120 Water Audit?
For us, it was feeling that we had product market fit and that we were ready to grow the team.
When was the moment where you welcomed, I think we've got product market fit?
Well, first of all, having more than just a couple of customers, and more than just customers that might be, you know, friends and family, if you will. And then enough of a track record of those customers using our product and renewing with us that they would be disappointed if our product, you know, didn't exist. And then another indicator is when people are like finding us and saying, you have just what I've been looking for.
When you're scaling up, is it, what is this, what is scaling up? Is it taking the product that's been working and bringing it to more of the same? Is it taking the product and finding new, different types of prospects? What does that mean for 120?
I mean, scaling the team to sell more of that product and then deliver, you know, what's been sold. So it's kind of those two fronts. On the product front, I would say we are kind of further hardening and kind of maturing both of our products so that they're further ready for scale. And then over time, then you have a chance, you hope as you're growing, you have more resources to, let's say, grow the team to go more expediently after new features and things like that. But for us right now, it's get to market. And as we get to market, make sure we've got the team that can deliver on the product that we have. And then for product and engineering to keep kind of delivering the right, I'd say somewhat incremental features at the right time, but make sure that platform is like rock solid and ready, you know, to have, maybe we've got 2,000 or 3,000 users right now, but a year from now, we could have 100,000 users or 50,000 users, making sure that we're rock solid for that.
You mentioned as you're scaling up, you're still trying to be nimble while still planning. So what is the legislative effect on your roadmap?
It informs what programs that we're focused on within the roadmap, if you will. So right now we have our plate full and there is tons of opportunity with the five programs that we support. And so we feel at the moment that several of those programs are going to continue to get more legislative attention, which is good for us. Lead in Schools is a good example.
What does it mean to get more legislative attention?
More states will say it is a law to test for lead in schools versus it being an optional program. We are supporting this program today. And in 2019 or 2020, are there any new program, like wholly new programs we have to get ready to support? And then underneath that is, you know, 10, 20, 50 features to support that. So the legislative tracker would kind of inform what new programs we might need to be ready for and when, or if there's any existing programs that may be being sunsetted, let's say.
What are the challenges of, like you said, hardening your product, but being flexible in your roadmap, open to change? Like, what are the challenges you face with that?
I think it's, first of all, kind of getting okay with being flexible, you know, just kind of the notion of that. So kind of waking up in the morning and saying that while we have a plan right now for Q1, if that plan were to change based on conditions, you know, in the next couple of weeks, like, that is okay. So part of it is just kind of getting in that right mindset or mentality. And I would say the other part of it is trying to find the balance. I mean, you can't live literally sprint to sprint, you know, or week to week. That probably is back in the days of the startup.
Why can't you do that anymore?
Well, because there's so many people involved, right? So you just from a planning and a design and an engineering, I mean, that's, you know, efficient and effective engineering is an assembly line, you know, and you've got a lot of different moving pieces. And so an area that we are improving on, and we still have a ways to go, just, you know, candidly, is getting further out ahead of the curve so that we are designing now, quote unquote, as an example, 2 and 3 and 4 sprints out, we'll say from a UX UI standpoint. We're kind of closing that gap. We're kind of turning that corner. But, you know, we're still doing a fair bit of real-time design that makes me, you know, give me a little heartburn, you know, certain days or certain weeks, but we're getting there.
What is the competition like today, typically, when you're trying to sell 120?
Well, the competition today, and this is, you know, real competition, is status quo. My Excel is good enough. My homegrown database is good enough. I'm good. So that's, you know, kind of first and foremost. We know that at present, we've created a software solution for a set of programs which hasn't had much software attention over the years. And there are a host of companies that are what I would think of as more kind of general purpose, horizontal compliance management enterprise software.
So not specific to water programs, but just any type of compliance.
And there are some that are specific to water. They tend to focus what we say more, I know it's a cliche, more upstream, like within the infrastructure, let's say the public water system and the sampling and testing that goes on there. The programs we're talking about are downstream at the point of use, the drinking water.
Okay.
But I think in general, there's a set of folks that have been in the game for a while that will at some point probably wake up and go, wait, what's going on over here? And then we'll see where things go.
I think a lot of times people start up, they don't always think of status quo as a competitor. They think of a competitor as the big bad guy that's the monolithic corporation or whatever. But in your case, it sounds like that a viable competitor is doing it the same way they always have or doing nothing. So when you face that competition with the 120 Water product, how do you win against that?
I think we would continue to try to win by embracing being industry specific, program aligned, if you will. Because I think one of the challenges a horizontal solution has in coming in is how do you can't always configure your way to something that feels like it was made just for a customer. So I think you would continue to see us double down in embracing being an industry specific solution versus a general horizontal, you know, platform that way.
What's the relationship between the status quo and market timing?
I think they're pretty interlinked, I guess you will. I think there are more things around market timing that can upend the status quo. So for instance, if legislative, like you must do this, is a market timing thing, that can actually move somebody past the status quo because then they have to do it. So that's a great question. That's probably just kind of in the moment here, the way you probably think about it. One is more of a you know, kind of a business side to it, and the other's more like personal. I mean, a lot of folks just don't like change.
Why does product leadership matter?
Everything in the world is or will become something through leadership. I mean, somebody or somebody's, a person or persons, you know, needs to get together and lead and decide, hey, this is where we're going. This is why we're doing it, and kind of plant a flag on the hill. So if you don't have that, it's kind of odd to say, but if you don't have leadership, there's nothing to manage. I mean, you got to go move things forward. And I just think it's a decent way to maybe think at a high level of the difference between product management and then product leadership. And oftentimes they are, and they should be intertwined, but they're, in my opinion, they're different things. And there's actually, depending on the time, different times call for different things. You know, sometimes if it's a new product and a new market opportunity, that might call for stronger product leadership. But if it's maybe something that's mature and you're humming along, maybe the emphasis there is more on product management.
What does better product mean to you?
What is better product? Something that makes people's lives better.
That was Dan Moyers, Head of Product and Solutions for 120 Water Audit. The best place to connect with Dan or anyone else on the 120 Water Audit team is 120wateraudit.com.
Why is product market fit so important? Why are people talking about it so much?
I think product market fit for startups is the evidence that you have something that the market wants. Because you can have a great product, and you see it a lot of times. You hear about things that are before their time. I think a lot of times we don't hear about things that are before their time because they never got any broad adoption. So I think we talk about product market fit for startups because that's really the thing that's going to tell them that they have something that's working in the market and that they should scale.
Yeah. The first thing he said, I mean, again, going back to it being really obvious, but he said, first of all, they have customers. And very obvious.
Note to our audience that if you have customers, that's a good sign.
Be on the way to product market fit.
But it's not enough.
Well, he defined the type of customers. He said, it's not just friends and family. And that's something we see a lot too. A lot of really early startups, they have customers, and then we go to talk with them. We learn that, and I think we see it a lot in this community too. A lot of local startups use each other. I think there's a really good, they want to help each other and want to support each other, but a lot of times they're not using their product necessarily because they actually have the pain. This next metric he talked about, I really like, and that's the idea that people would be disappointed if your product didn't exist.
Yeah.
I think that's a really, really interesting way to think about it.
Why do you think that is so important? To determine product market fit.
I think it's because when you can integrate yourself into people's workflows and when you can become a tool that they depend and count on, that means they're really finding the value in what you do. And so if you were to take that tool away, they would lose that value.
It's like if I give iPads to my kids, they're customers, they're happy. They love it. And then the next morning they come and use it again, they're renewing. That's all good. But if you ever try to take an iPad away from a kid while they're using it, and see that's when you know you've got a great product. All right, so he had one more, I don't know if he intended to do this, but in the way that we're talking about it too, I feel like it's almost layering product market fit. So it's not have customers, it's not just are they renewing, it's not just would they be disappointed if your product exists. He also talked about our inbound people asking for it. So I think that's like that balance because you can have a good product and some people don't know how it fits. But if they start to see that means it's positioned right and they're messaging it to you right. It's designed well and it hits all those. So I think that's that fourth level where now all of a sudden people that are out there in the world that are coming inbound think that you can solve their problems. And I think that's really key for 120 because they're in a space where it's not common. They're not doing, you know, like HR software. Or
there's not a lot of competitors out there.
Yeah. So it is kind of a new thing. It's like if a new competitor Slack comes out, we're all going to kind of understand that. But in 120's case, it's like totally net new to that field. So for them to then see that something I'd never seen before is the thing I need, that is like the most, you know, the biggest evidence of fit.
Validate the problem exists, the solution solves the problem, and people find value in it.
So I think the other thing that's, I think, related to the product market fit that I know you were really interested in is the idea of being customer informed rather than just being customer led.
Dan had a really interesting perspective on this. And because he works in, you know, a regulated environment, potentially government organizations, he mentioned that they don't just build to their customers. They, they're more thought leaders. So they're very customer informed, not customer driven or led, which is a little different from what we've heard from other people and what we hear, you know, differently throughout the ecosystem.
What do you think the, like, what are the differences in, at least in the way you interpret being informed versus led?
I think when you're customer led, maybe it's when you're further along down your path, like the company's more mature, the product's more mature, you're much more designing to what customers need and want from your product. But when you're customer, just customer informed, kind of like what Dan said, you are leading customers down, you are being thought leaders, you're telling them this is the best way to go about it. They know that the problem exists and they can articulate the problem, but they have no idea what the solution should be. So you're more of saying, I understand your problem and here's the solution that you need. Right. Now you have to be customer informed because you can't just, you know, shove a product down people's throats and hope it fits. You have to get feedback from them.
If I reflect back on even your career and mine in UX and in research, I feel like a lot of the software in the early 2000s was kind of like customer driven. Like the idea of waterfall and in these large scale, these long contracts you would get with companies, you're almost just building effectively what they want.
Exactly.
Yeah, and they'll pay the bills, but then you can't scale that. And you know, now we fast forward to today where we're in the SaaS model and you need to build something that many people can use. But to your point, I feel, at least the way I interpret that customer led, the customer is just leading you, you're just kind of doing what they want. But in his case, he balances that too, because he does mention that they have to stay ahead, but they also have to give them what they want. What was your reaction to some of the things he said there, where how the managing that balance between leading customers, but not so far ahead that you start to lose the connection with them?
He was really thoughtful about it because he's working in an industry where they don't, again, there's not a lot of competitors. There's not a lot of people in this space. And so I think he is, you know, it sounds like he's leading people along the way with them. They're doing lots and lots of demos. He's in a lot of contact with his customers. So it sounds like he's leading them, but he's bringing them too.
He also seemed to talk about specifically, I think it was a customer in Wisconsin, R&D. It almost seemed like he had the cutting edge customer where it's like that they get the new features first.
Because they're open-minded to it. They want to try them out.
I think too, when you do that with the people that are totally open to change with those types of customers, I think Dan's also talking to them because they help. They're almost like a translator for the ones that are maybe like further on the other edge of not being ready. It's like, I mean, Dan and Megan Glover, the CEO, really know their customers well. But I think if you can go to those more cutting edge, open customers first, they can help hone. Maybe it's not just the product, but it can help hone it so that when you then go to somebody else, they've at least given you a little bit of better way to package the product or some things.
How you
may
talk
have missed
about
the
product,
design.
How you message the product. He's pushing his customers beyond what they have today, but he's also doing the most advanced yet most acceptable, right? It still fits in their world. They can still understand it.
And it is advanced. Yeah, I think that's important. Right. Like, it's not just acceptable. He's not just designing
exactly
what they customer want. Driven. They're just giving him what they want. And it's not so advanced. And we kind of joked about the iPad earlier, but I think what Apple's always done well is kind of created products that really are just sort of like, what you guys are going to do what we do. But 120 doesn't have the marketing budget and the brand at Apple that can truly push an entire consumer base in a direction. So for the rest of us, and I think a lot of our listeners, you're not going to have the luxury of just being able to put something out there and everybody's going to get on board. For the rest of, we hope, a lot of people hope they can get there. But I think when you're on that road, you do need, like you said, that most advanced yet acceptable framework, I think is really good. And I think you hit it right on the head that 120 does that really well.
Thanks so much for listening to the show this week. If you haven't yet, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Until then, visit innovatemap.com/podcast and subscribe to learn how you can take your product to the next level. As always, we're curious, what does better product mean to you? Hit us up on Twitter at InnovateMap or shoot us an email at podcast@innovatemap.com.
I'm Christian.
And I'm Anna. And you've been listening to Better Product.
Better Product.
Drop mic.